Abby, I'd like to start with you. In terms of our podcast today, we're looking at humanitarian access. And of course, humanitarian access denial is increasingly difficult, specifically in civilian protection. And we think a little bit about what are some of the enabling factors and disabling factors that lead to a positive outcome. Could you speak a little bit about some of these factors in your work?
So in terms of enabling factors, what we looked at mainly was security, at least in the phase of research that I was most involved in, and looking at the effects that security or insecurity have on the levels of humanitarian presence and coverage for a population in need. And what we found very clearly is that this security or the lack of it is a much stronger determinant of humanitarian presence than the actual needs of people on the ground or even the availability of funding. And we saw that demonstrated both by the data we gathered on humanitarian presence and by interviews with aid organizations on the ground about what goes into their decision making. So that's true both globally across emergencies. You know, you see the countries with the highest number of violent incidents having the lowest number of aid organizations responding. And within countries where you see insecurity negatively correlated with the level of humanitarian presence in any given area.
Thanks. So this is Julia. And I'd like to follow up on that and ask Abby or Catherine if you'd like to join in, or Will as well, on the relationship between humanitarian law and access in insecure environments. We know that IHL regulates humanitarian access and seeks to enable humanitarian actors to reach populations in need, but how do practitioners actually perceive their rights and responsibilities under IHL, and how IHL supports them in achieving access, especially in insecure conflict environments?
This is Abby. I can take a first stab at that, which is just to say that while IHL is considered important and is the basis for the principles of good humanitarian action, on the ground practically, there's not much direct relationship between how an organization is going to be present and delivering in a certain area and IHL. I think it's taken as a given that just because you're humanitarian does not mean that you are afforded any protection by non-state actors. You have to negotiate that for yourself. It's different if you're the ICRC, for instance, where promotion of international human rights is, international humanitarian law is kind of key to their mission. But for your average NGO trying to deliver humanitarian aid, unfortunately, it's not really present in daily activities.
Thanks. And as a follow-up to that, we've talked about IHL a little bit. How much do the humanitarian principles matter in negotiating and achieving access? Specifically, how do organizations think about neutrality and impartiality when they're entering into difficult areas and trying to achieve access and proximity?
Hi, this is Catherine. I can take that question. So I think the first thing to understand is that delivering principled and quality aid in war zones is just incredibly difficult. Aid agencies are faced with difficult choices all the time. So basically, they're weighing a complex set of risks and benefits and really making these decisions that have ethical consequences in terms of who gets assistance and who does not, and sort of how that's seen in the local environment, how it may affect conflict dynamics. So one of the things this study found really clearly is that basically to get the job done, aid staff and aid organizations are making compromises and concessions all the time just to be able to deliver what they said they would deliver and to maintain their access. So this can include sort of obvious things like paying money at checkpoints or paying unofficial taxes or bribes or employing local militia when you need guards in your compound. But it can also be more subtle, so altering targeting criteria so that certain elites are included on the distribution lists or just not working in some areas so that you don't antagonize a local authority. So essentially what the lesson is that adhering to the core humanitarian principles, it doesn't mean avoiding these types of compromises or contradictions at all costs. So really it's about deciding when the compromises are worth it and when they're not. and which types of compromises might be acceptable and which might not be in a given situation. So despite this, we found that most agencies we spoke with, they've maintained a pretty simplistic view of humanitarian principles. They just sort of embrace them uncritically, just say, of course, we follow the principles, but they don't tend to unpack them about what they really mean. And so we haven't really seen any kind of honest discussion about the types of compromises that are being made in the field and what that means from the point of view of humanitarian principles. So we need to allow for this kind of more sophisticated approach to humanitarian principles.
And I'd like to bring this question to Will. Abby talked a little bit about the importance of security and understanding the context in which access negotiations are happening. And we know that some organizations may be more willing or able to consistently operate in areas versus others. Could you talk a little bit about which organizations in your experience have had the most success? What features of those organizations, you don't have to name them themselves, but what characteristics of those agencies make them more successful?
Hi, this is Will. The humanitarian access negotiations have been a significant part of our study. It's difficult to draw precisely upon what makes one negotiation successful rather than what's principled and what should be effective. So can't directly draw correlation between how it happens. But to tell you a bit more about what the state of play is, there are generally mixed feelings about access negotiations. Only half of respondents sometimes feel it's acceptable for aid agencies to speak with non-state arms groups. A few thought it was unacceptable outright, and a few more thought it was dependent upon the nature of the arms group. There's also some dynamics which affect the quality or approach to access negotiations, whether it's done directly or indirectly through say communities. Slightly more organizations will choose to indirectly do this. Much of the time this is done through national staff, often from that area or from an area where the arms group operates, and quite infrequently do international staff get involved with access negotiations. So a couple of the things that we've seen is that whilst people recognize it's extremely important for principled access negotiations to take place to reach the most vulnerable in difficult areas, there's been little investment in terms of training. And over the past couple of years, for most organizations, only a small number, probably a quarter, have had any organizational training on humanitarian negotiations for access. We also see sometimes there's not so much organizational control as to planning and implementing a negotiation strategy. Often this is delegated to a national staff member. So we have seen an acceptance that negotiations are really important, and we're still seeing this field develop. But at the moment, there's uneven developments across the field.
Thanks, Will. And as a follow-up, I'd like to open it up to Abby and Catherine as well. Regarding this question of insecurity, OCHA has also talked about other constraints that contribute to denial of access, like bureaucratic constraints, intensifying hostilities, or increasing insecurity, but also violence against humanitarian personnel. Could you speak a little bit about how those factors influence access on the ground?
Right. Well, a lot of them relate back to insecurity. Logistical access, for instance, in South Sudan is extremely difficult, which is why most of the operations have been sort of these one-off deliveries and air transport. But the logistics capacity would be much easier to develop if there was not fighting currently going on. So it kind of comes back to insecurity in that case. There are also, in some countries, as you say, the political and bureaucratic obstacles to working in certain places. And these are all factors, but if you want to look at what really keeps organizations out or makes them leave or reduce their presence, it's violence, because these organizations have taken casualties, and it's quite a serious issue in the small kind of handful of humanitarian contexts where there's extreme conflict happening.
Thanks, and I'd like to go back to the issue of quality programming. We have a question from our listener, Pedro, who writes that one way of increasing access and operations in difficult environments has been to work through local actors or remote management, but that this can have implications in terms of less control of operations and less quality in programs, as several of you have mentioned. So how do you balance this? How do organizations think about the implications for operating in security environments with reduced visibility, reduced oversight, and increased reliance on national partners? What are the implications of that for quality?
Hi, this is Catherine. I can take that question. Well, yes, I think absolutely we've seen remote management and the increasing use of partners as a way to increase an international agency's access is having increased over the last few years. It's just an increasingly common practice, even though it's widely acknowledged to be less than ideal. And I think one of the things our research found was the importance of being very conscious of the kind of staff that you're hiring and how they are perceived on the ground. So these types of staff, it's not just about having the right ethnicity or being of the right nationality, but really looking at what are their personal networks, how well known, how trusted are they on the ground, because that is going to be key in terms of being able to deliver, first to maintain your access, but also to be able to deliver a quality program that is not just corrupt, but is really impartial and meeting the needs of the most vulnerable people. And just overall, in general, we found that corruption at the field level, at the program level, is really a major problem, a major barrier for affected people to be able to receive aid. That issue came up in all of the countries from the consultations we did with affected people in these four countries. So these types of low-level bias and favoritism are very, very frequent, and they really need to be addressed kind of throughout the organization, which goes back to the issue of becoming more open within your organization about what types of compromises are taking place, and really just accepting that these things happen and that we need to be able to talk about them and not just sweep them under the rug.
And Catherine, actually, you mentioned the importance of perception, and I'd like to talk a little bit about you and your colleagues' understanding of the perception of agencies on the ground. And we have someone calling in. Frederick from Cameroon asks, how can humanitarian organizations ensure access and proximity, respect for principles in contexts such as Afghanistan or others where violent extremist or so-called jihadist groups are operating? How effective are the principles for negotiating access in these contexts? And how do you manage perceptions of neutrality and impartiality?
I don't know that we've been able to look specifically at jihadist versus other types of organizations. In these contexts, there are many different types of armed actors with different ideologies. We haven't seen necessarily a split between those types of organizations and others, but nor is it something that we focused on specifically with this research. So I'm not sure I can comment on that. I mean, we do see that from the point of view of donors, they're becoming increasingly concerned about fiduciary risks. So making sure that aid does not get diverted to armed actors or other authorities on the ground. And this is especially the case where there's designated terrorist organizations. So, and this is actually something that affects where agencies are able to work. For example, we saw this in Somalia and Syria, that does play a role. Security is the predominating factor, but the risk of fiduciary problems is another big factor as well. So from that point of view, that also presents real challenges to how principled the agencies can be perceived as being when they're only working in, say, government-held areas. So that's a real concern when you have perhaps a jihadist or another sort of designated terrorist organization, and then you have aid organizations working mainly in government-held areas.
And Will, I'd like to also invite you to comment on this question.
Hi, this is Will. Yeah, I completely agree with Catherine. One other thing that we see is that the humanitarian principles, for many reasons, serve as some kind of ethical basis for how aid agencies are identified. Whilst humanity and impartiality are, you know, very important in terms of differentiating aid agencies in Afghanistan and in other countries from other development projects which have different objectives, one thing that we've seen is really the importance of independence as a, you know, really critical humanitarian principle that makes a large difference in terms of both the organization and their acceptance in high risk areas.
And I have a question. I think I'll ask Catherine first, but open it up to others. We have a question from a listener in Thailand who's curious about how agencies reconcile the balance between staff safety and welfare and program criticality or pressure for results. You mentioned donors and the importance of donors pushing for responsibility on behalf of their recipient organization. So is there a trade-off between the imperative for program delivery and impartiality or thinking about risk management and security in these settings?
I guess the short answer is yes. There's always going to be tension between the need to keep one's staff safe and the humanitarian needs on the ground. And what we've seen is that many of the larger humanitarian agencies in particular are becoming increasingly sophisticated in how they do risk management. So they're assessing all different types of risk, not just security risks, but also legal, financial, reputational risks. And yet in these systems, we haven't seen any real formal or structured way to think about program criticality. So to look at how urgent or life-saving the intervention that is being conducted is, and then to balance this against the level of risk being taken. So what we'd like to see is more detailed looks at program criticality, and so to be able to take more risk in the most urgent situations and less risk in the less urgent situations.
Abby, I'd like to ask you a question regarding, sort of building on this, regarding the multitude of actors on the ground. There may be dilemmas inherent with this diversification of actors. And there may be a tension between promoting collaborative communication and transparency around activities and presence while also protecting and implementing one agency's mandate, which in some cases may rest on a fragile agreement between the stakeholders. Could you speak a little bit about this?
Well, if I understand your question, it's about how we can get organizations to be more transparent and to share their information, even in areas where they might feel that their security is genuinely imperiled by that. Is that right?
Exactly, yes. Mm-hmm.
So it really is one of the key information management challenges of humanitarian coordination, keeping in mind that humanitarian response is a mostly voluntary endeavor, and it's made up of many, many organizations that all have different incentives for being there and thresholds for risk and levels of capacity to operate in difficult environments. It's a struggle to bring them together in a way that you can see the entire operational picture, which is to the benefit of the people you're trying to serve, but also keeping everyone feeling secure in their information. So in the first place, organizations really need to be more precise as well as transparent about their numbers of staff, the activities that they're doing, and the locations of their operations, and record these and track these year by year. And because this is, as I say, a voluntary endeavor, it's no good for some organizations to be quite transparent while others are not, because then you never get the full picture. So it's something that has to be done jointly across the humanitarian system, and it really needs to start with a common methodology for calculating the people in need from among the affected population. And then, you know, apart from that, you need more robust information management systems for mapping this operational activity and methodologies for tracking and reporting on what types of rapid response or other types of deliveries that the organizations are doing and the populations that they're reaching. So it's not easy. I think it's coordination is never easy, even under the best of circumstances. And in insecure situations, agencies tend to share less rather than more information. But it's really important, mainly for identifying where the people in need are who are not yet accessing humanitarian aid.
And I'd like to turn to Will with a question on more practical methods and tools. We've discussed many of the challenges inherent here, but we know that you're working on a toolkit for humanitarian negotiations based on many of these lessons. So what, in your view, are key methods or tools that can help practitioners to enhance negotiations and access in these environments?
Hi, this is Will. I'm very excited about the toolkit that we will hope to put out in the next few months. There's no one tool fits all. I guess the approach that we'll look to take is to strengthen how organizations respond to access issues through negotiations. And a couple of key areas that we might focus on will be partly how to deal with mediation if indirect negotiations are a major feature of the humanitarian operation in this current time, how that process can be managed properly, and also how internally within an organization its own policies could help support country directors or representatives and their area-based staff to better implement a negotiation strategy in full confidence that they'll be supported and protected themselves. It's always a highly risky endeavor, both for security but also for reputational and legal issues too, to engage in some of these this type of outreach with non-state armed groups.
And by way of follow-up, and I'd like to invite the others to comment as well, I understand that there is a great need among humanitarian professionals for more standardized or adequate training around tools and methods on strategic planning, stakeholder analysis, understanding legal norms, and so forth. But there may also be a tension between valuing the identity and the professional experience of an individual versus what we may build as a competence, as a community around of negotiators across contexts. Could you speak a little bit about how you would imagine such a community evolving? What are some of the competences and skills that would be required? And how do we define relationships among each other as professionals in this environment?
I can take that. This is Catherine. I think what we've seen is that there's as Will was saying, there's a real need for more guidance and discussion about humanitarian negotiations. The state of practice is still pretty rudimentary, just in the sense that many humanitarian staff and organizations are uncertain about whether they're even allowed to engage with non-state armed actors in order to enable access. And many engage indirectly, so using community elders, for example, as interlocutors, not because this is the only or best option, but because they lack certainty as to whether they're allowed to engage directly. So really, it's the local staff on the ground that are most involved in these negotiations, and these are very, very local staff. So not just national staff, but staff who are from the area, who have friends and family who may be part of these armed groups. So they're in an incredibly difficult position, facing incredible pressure, and so what they need is more support and skills as to how to negotiate effectively and with integrity. And they really need to know what the position of their organization is with regards to these types of negotiations. So I would just encourage the humanitarian community to really focus on who is conducting the negotiations and who realistically will continue to do so that we understand their experiences and their needs and can support them better.
Thanks, and I'd like to open it up to the rest of the panel for concluding remarks as our time is drawing to a close. What are your final thoughts on what works best in obtaining access and delivering quality programs in insecure environments? What has your work and your research indicated is needed for the future? What's most important moving forward?
Sure. This is Catherine again. I mean, it's a multiple set of things that we see coming out of this study. There's no one specific single factor that or practice that makes a difference in enabling access. So we don't have a magic bullet, but we do have a multitude of practices that do seem to make a difference. And I guess if you sort of link them all together, a key one is independence, as Will said, and it kind of goes together hand in hand with a sort of focus on the most vulnerable people and trying to relieve suffering. suffering and essentially looking to see where those people are and taking decisions about the level of risks that you're willing to take on in accordance with those needs. And really being more open as an organization about the fact that to be principled doesn't simply mean, you know, just saying that you're independent, that you're impartial, that you're neutral. It really means thinking more openly and honestly about the types of ethical risks that you're dealing with and the kind of compromises that are happening on the ground and that will continue to happen. So it's being able to discuss these openly with your staff at all levels and ensuring that you have the independence to fulfill the spirit of humanity, essentially.
And Abby, your concluding thoughts.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Catherine said, that there really is no one formula that works everywhere. And we saw in the four different countries that we looked at that there are different types of models that organizations were using in order to kind of maintain a secure presence so that they could keep operating. And whether that was in Afghanistan through very localized programming and low profile or mainly through partners in South Central Somalia, you see over the years that a norm begins to develop of how to operate. In addition to the very good practices and basic principles that Catherine mentioned, it would seem to be prudent for organizations to really start thinking innovatively about how to access the populations that simply aren't being served right now because they are in areas where it's deemed too insecure to operate, and you have the organizations clustering their presence and their activities in places where it's safer, right? So you have kind of reverse levels of coverage where the need isn't as great. So there are potentially other actors, whether they are local organizations or local private sector, that could potentially be used as ways to get aid to the people who are not getting it now. And in addition to doing what they can to remain operational and operate safely, I think it would behoove organizations to think about what else they can do because there really is a paucity of aid presence in certain places in these insecure environments.
And Will?
Hi, this is Will. From our research, from my perspective on some of the research, what's needed looking forward is that whilst organizations have responded to really increased risks of situations, of security risks, legal risks, there's been some practices for good and for bad reasons which have been some effective and some not so effective, but the not so effective ones have been brushed aside, overlooked, neglected, often intentionally. So what's needed looking forward perhaps is a really honest conversation or forum or advocacy around some of these issues which we often overlook. Things like, as Catherine and Abby have mentioned, the low-level corruption and bias, some of the issues around perhaps donor regulations and organizational policies in clarity to whom you can deal with, whether organizations really are paying for access, either in monetary terms or not. These are issues which are really affecting the impact of aid in insecure places, and it's difficult for us to see, and it's a difficult and thorny topic for us to discuss. So I guess one thing that at least from my point of view is that we could look to bring this to the fore in an honest and constructive way that really puts the beneficiaries, puts vulnerable persons at the center of aid work.
Will, Catherine, Abby, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks.